This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. Each week in this podcast, I'll talk to some of the leading thinkers and researchers, entrepreneurs and executives about things like conscious capitalism, sustainability, and business ethics. Things that feel all the more urgent as we as a planet face enormous challenges. Climate change, pandemics, demands for social reform. Many of these challenges brought about, some would argue, by capitalism. Each episode, each guest, will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. In today's episode, we're going for a bit of a paradigm shift. Today we're talking with Mary Inman, one of the world's leading lawyers for corporate whistleblowers, about what happens when an employee's serious concerns about safety, fraud, waste, and abuse go unheeded by management, and sometimes corporate boards of directors, thereby putting at risk not only the reputation of the company, but often the life and well-being of the public.
I knew how seriously Theranos protected their trade secrets. I knew they would not take it well if they knew that I was talking to regulators.
And now for the part about the paradigm shift. Mary will explain that whistleblowers can actually be a valuable resource for management. After more than 20 years of experience representing whistleblowers in the U.S., Mary moved to London in 2017 to help Konstantin Cannon start an international whistleblower practice. Mary discusses the challenges whistleblowers and companies face when wrongdoings are reported. Well, Mary Inman, welcome to the What Does It Profit podcast. How are you doing?
I am doing so well, Dawn. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, no, it's great to finally track you down. Sometimes I find you on the West Coast and the East Coast. I guess you're up in Maine, right?
I'm in Maine at the moment. Yes, Northern Maine.
I guess that's probably better than being stuck in your London office. Not that London's not a fabulous place, but I'm sure now that they're keeping Americans out for a while, you're safe stateside.
Yes. When you're talking about density, I'm in a low density area at the moment. So I love cities, but they're high density areas.
Well, great. Stay safe and take care of yourself because you are taking care of a lot of really important people. You're here today to talk with us about your work with whistleblowers.
I am, and thank you. It is a privilege that I've had for about 23 years now to wake up every morning and help whistleblowers in whatever scandal, corruption scandal, crisis du jour.
You're working on stuff that ends up in Hollywood movies, and you know we'll talk about that later in their conversation. But I have to tell you, before we go anywhere with this, when I think of whistleblowers, I think of like the pigtail little girl on the playground that's the tattletale. Is that what you think of when you think of whistleblowers?
No, when I think of whistleblowers, I think much more, maybe that's what I thought 23 years ago, but working with them now, I think very much about courageous heroes and people who risk personal health, safety, and careers to help all of us expose corruption that benefits the public interest.
Well, I think I've heard you in an interview or two talk about this idea that whistleblowers don't even sometimes realize they're whistleblowers.
That's absolutely right. I think I would say almost 60% of my whistleblowers are just doing their jobs. And if your job involves being head of audit and reporting good, bad, and indifferent news to the board and the management company, when you have bad news to report, there's an often a shoot the messenger mentality. And unfortunately, our whistleblowers don't realize that they've stepped in it until after, depending on the reaction that the people they speak to have. So it's only after they do their job, say that, you know, we've found a 30% error rate in our Medicare billings. We need to tell the Medicare program. And when that is not warmly received by the management, then they are often routinely treated as the messenger who's shot for bringing bad news.
Well, what's the profile of a whistleblower? You just mentioned someone we might normally think of, someone in compliance or audit, but where do you find whistleblowers and what do they look like?
So that is an important question because I think everyone wants to figure out what is the typical whistleblower, the stereotypical whistleblower. In my experience, I've sort of lump them into two categories. There are a lot of people who come to us who I would call sort of the soapbox whistleblowers, And there are people who just cannot abide by any wrongdoing. And so when they see something that's improper, they bring it forward. And so those kinds of whistleblowers with a very strong moral compass can come from anywhere, really. So I don't think there's really a particular position in a company that they might come from. We've had people who are in the mailroom all the way up to the highest place whistleblower we've ever had is a vice president of a Fortune 500 company. But the other type of whistleblower that I think is interesting, and I had no idea about really until I went into this line of work, is a much more practical whistleblower who's one who is blowing the whistle out of a, almost from a defensive posture, that out of a concern that if they don't blow the whistle, maybe the person in the cubicle beside them will, and that they need to do that to protect themselves. And I think that's honestly part of what has come with the success of the whistleblower programs, is I think a lot more people are being deterred in the workplace, just realizing that because whistleblowers could be anywhere in the organization, that they recognize that there is risk for them, and that when wrongdoing is taking place, it's probably in their interest to be one of the first to speak up.
Well, when these whistleblowers speak up, who are they going to? Are they going to their managers? Are they calling you? Are they calling the press? How does this get out? And how does it escalate into something you'd call whistleblowing as opposed to just maybe constructive observation?
Yeah, I think your listeners will be happy to hear that most whistleblowers, and we actually have some quantitative data here from the SEC, that 85% of the whistleblowers that report to the SEC's whistleblower program on accounting violations or Foreign Practices Act violations, 85% of them tried not once, not twice, but usually three times internally to report the wrongdoing and have their company correct it. I think that's a really encouraging and important statistic, and it's certainly been borne out with what I see in my practice, which is that most people do not want to take the life-altering course of being a whistleblower, given that it can have so many negative repercussions. They don't want to throw their career away, all the training that they have done, and they just are hopeful that this is something, information that the company would value and would want to know and correct. So most whistleblowers do not run to the press, do not run to me. It's only after they've been ignored, sidelined, silenced, and get frustrated that they basically have no other choice but to go to alternate routes like law enforcement or to the press.
Well, you know, we can sit here and talk about this from a very theoretical perspective, but what does this mean in the life of a real person? Tell us about Tyler Schultz, who I understand is one of your clients.
I'm always happy to talk about Tyler. He is a remarkable individual. And for folks who are the few who haven't read the book Bad Blood by John Carreyrou or know about the movie, a couple, there's an HBO documentary called The Inventor and a podcast even. Tyler Schultz is one of two whistleblowers who basically exposed and put a black eye on what was otherwise the golden child of Theranos, the blood testing company, and Elizabeth Holmes.
I had a personal relationship with Elizabeth. She was close to my family, and I felt like she was deceiving my family and the public.
Wait a minute, I can't let this go. I mean, you've got to tell people what Theranos was saying they were actually in the business of doing. You know, me as a, a needle phobic person, you know, thought this was the most amazing possibility in the whole world. What was Theranos purporting to be able to do?
So it was a very compelling story. And like you, as a needle phobic, I was rooting for Elizabeth Holmes and her company. So Elizabeth Holmes, a Stanford dropout, who dropped out of Stanford because she was so eager to get to her next entrepreneurial act, she came up with the idea as a biology student at Stanford that it would revolutionize the blood testing world if instead of doing a venous blood draw, which we all hate when we go into the lab, if you could just do a finger prick, taking one drop of blood and get the same test results that you would get from multiple venous blood draws. That's what she was saying she could do with one prick of a finger, because she herself was saying that she was needle phobic, and how this could be deployed so quickly, even in the field, in the military, right? You can imagine if you're able to do it that quickly, and she could do it in a small portable device that would test as many as some hundred, something like 200 different types of blood draw analyses.
All right. My grandma was absolutely right. If it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true. One of the things I find fascinating about this story is that she got a pretty amazing set of investors and supporters and an incredibly venerable board. Who were some of the folks that she was able to connect with the company that gave her this type of credibility that normally a 19-year-old college dropout isn't going to get?
You're right. She had a gold-starred board. Literally, she had General Mattis on her board. She had Henry Kissinger. She had Tyler Shultz's grandfather, George Shultz, former Secretary of State, and many others. So what was interesting about all of them is that none of them, all while they are gold-plated in the statesman political realm, none of them had science backgrounds, which becomes very important as the story unfolds.
Okay, so here she is. She's has this incredible claim. And then what's going on in the company?
So the company starts, like many startups, started out small and then ultimately grew very quickly, as I think really when Elizabeth Holmes was featured on the cover of Forbes magazine, and as the board started to attract more and more people, it started smaller and then just blossomed to 800 employees. So what I find remarkable here is that out of 800 employees who were aware of the fact that although this started out as something, I think like a lot of startups, you hope that you'll be able to achieve this revolutionary technology, and it takes some trial and error. When it became very clear that it was all error, and that in fact, what they were doing is, because they couldn't get the devices to work, they instead started testing them the regular way. And in fact, were giving, when they were testing it the way on their faulty machines that hadn't really been prototyped and perfected yet, they were actually sending faulty test results to certain of the Walgreens outlets that were using the Theranos technology.
Well, that's not, in my mind, that's not only greed, but that's is negligence. I mean, imagine the people who rely on those test results. I suspect that's a big part of the magnitude of the scandal.
Absolutely, absolutely. The fact that she wasn't just selling, she was selling a service that gives, that that our doctors rely upon to properly treat us, is makes it all the more important that the technology worked properly, of course.
Okay, now there are 800 employees at this company. Tyler Shultz is one of them. What is he doing in the company?
So Tyler is working in the lab. He started, interestingly, when Elizabeth Holmes was the darling of Silicon Valley, everyone wanted a job there. So he asked his grandfather when he was an undergrad at Stanford, studying biology, if he could work there for the summer. And that's how it started. So he was still an undergrad when he started to see that this technology wasn't what it promised to be. He said within 2 weeks, he was able to tell that things were not as they were advertising it. So he starts in the lab. And what this becomes really interesting is that he does have the assistance of one other whistleblower named Erica Chung, who was in a different part of the company that was experiencing the same thing. And I think, and seeing similar things from a different vantage point. And I think it was really the two of them being able to talk to one another that gave Tyler the courage to ultimately talk to the Wall Street Journal when that opportunity arose. But before they did that, he and Erica both wrote to the New York laboratory boards and other things, to state regulatory authorities, to advise them of the problems. Tyler did that under a pseudonym, anonymously. And unfortunately, he, because the information he gave to the regulatory authority included particular numbers that were very specific for test results. And when John Carreyrou, the reporter, asked them for comment, they were able to put and use those numbers. They were able to put two and two together and figure out that it was Tyler who had spoken to the Wall Street Journal.
Okay, he's busted by the numbers. But you mentioned earlier in our conversation that there's this phenomenon that tends to happen where you try to escalate and bring up the concerns internally. Did Tyler do any of that, or was it just so shocking that, you know, he just went a different route?
No, he did go the traditional route, which is that he raised these concerns all the way up to Elizabeth Holmes. And Elizabeth and Sonny Balwani, who was another sort of one of the head leaders of the company, they both wrote back to him and squashed his and basically said they would have fired him then on the spot if it wasn't for the fact that he had a very famous grandfather. So he tried to report it internally and got the back of the hand by the two people who were in the position to correct it. So he took it up to the top of the proverbial chain.
Well, how about at Thanksgiving dinner with Grandpa? I mean, did he try that route?
He absolutely did. So when he wasn't received that way, I think that's really why when he was approached by the Wall Street Journal reporter that he really wanted to preserve his grandfather's legacy. He did not want this to tarnish him. He had survived the Iran-Contra hearings and other many scandals when he was the Secretary of State, and he didn't want this to be the thing that was his downfall. So he did try and tell his grandfather. And it's actually a very, probably one of the most dramatic parts of Tyler's story is that when he went to tell his grandfather, lawyers from Boies Schiller were in the house and they used that opportunity to basically ambush him and serve him with a restraining order, telling him that he can't talk to the press anymore and that he was violating confidentiality agreements and trade secret information.
Yikes. If you can't go home, where can you go? What, I mean, it sounds like an incredibly stressful, anxiety-filled environment. But what happened to this guy?
So this is where I think it's really important to bring Erica Chung into the picture, because I think the experience of many whistleblowers, and this is certainly true of Tyler, is that it can be incredibly isolating, because if everyone around you has drank the Kool-Aid and you're the one who's starting to raise issues and no one supports you, and then when they start to see, when your colleagues start to see what happens when you start to raise concerns and you get treated, you're retaliated against, and then they sort of almost treat you like you're contagious. Like, you know, I don't want to catch that treatment, the whistleblower treatment, so I'm just going to keep my head down and ignore. So what happens to whistleblowers is they start to begin to doubt themselves. They get isolated. They're separated from their peers. And that can sometimes often delay the time for a whistleblower to report. And so that's when they often will reach out for legal help. And then we help and walk them through that. No, you're not crazy. And here, all the stuff that you've showed us corroborates what you're seeing. And but before that step happened, Tyler had the camaraderie of Erica Chung, who also had experienced something similar. And I think that's really important, because I think we would have many more whistleblower submissions if there was room for solidarity among employees to sort of talk through the problem, say that they both saw the same thing, and then bring it together. And I think it's harder to actually dismiss when you have different employees from different areas of the practice both seeing similar problems and bringing it forward. So I raise that just because I think the relationship between Erica certainly helped embolden Tyler to come forward and to recognize that, no, he isn't crazy and there is a problem here.
I have to ask, I mean, if they're working in different parts of the company, how did they find each other? I mean, how did they, you know, one day around the water cooler, are they saying, man, this technology is like crazy. It's, you know, it was so obvious. I mean, is there some type of, you know, Whistleblowers Anonymous in the parking lot?
You know, I actually don't know how they first were put in touch with each other. So that's a great question. And I'm not even sure that John Carreyrou covers it in the book. So I wish I could give you the answer on how they found each other.
Oh, that's too bad. I thought we'd have breaking news out of the What Does It Profit podcast, but not today. we'll find Tyler on social media when we release the episode and see if he can add some color as to how to find solidarity among colleagues rooting out corruption. But that's another conversation. So how did this thing wind itself through? I mean, where are things now, and you know, what's happening?
So as a result of Tyler's bringing the information to the public through John Carreyrou in the Wall Street Journal, he also was able to bring this information to the SEC. And so he has, the the way that I represent him is that he availed himself of the SEC whistleblower program. And so I'm representing him in that capacity. So the SEC and the DOJ have brought charges against Elizabeth Holmes and Sunny Balwani. That's where it stands into, at least as to criminal charges. The SEC took regulatory action against Elizabeth, barred her from serving on the board of any publicly traded company for 10 years. I think fined her $500,000, and they have taken similar action against Sunny Balwani, but his trial is also waiting.
Well, is Theranos still an ongoing concern doing some aspect of their business? Was Tyler employed? You know, where does that stand?
These are great questions. I'm happy to say Tyler is employed. I think it's an interesting question that I've been trying to consider is that are whistleblowers from Silicon Valley able to weather the storm of being targeted as whistleblowers than folks in other industries? Tyler actually has his own company, biology company, and he is proposing, I think he's working on a product that sounds he will tell you with a smile, sounds an awful lot like Theranos, except it's able to detect certain conditions by saliva swabs from your mouth. So he's an inventor and is continuing to try and create products. So that's where Tyler is happily gainfully employed. And I think most importantly for your listeners, he has gone on with Erica Chung's leadership to create a nonprofit called Ethics and Entrepreneurship, in which they are helping folks in Silicon Valley and startup areas around the world to think about ethics from in the inception, learning from Theranos that if they as a very beginning company had thought about baking in ethics to their culture, then when they were barreling down the road and getting very successful, maybe we would have had a different result.
Well, it sounds like there's a happy ending to this story for everyone, probably except the investors.
Yes, this is very true. And I think that's why it's very unusual for the SEC to take action against company and on behalf of investors of privately held companies. The idea is that their mandate is to protect the more unsophisticated Main Street investor. The investors here were incredibly sophisticated, but I think it was the flagrancy of the fraud that made the SEC decide that they would put their resources towards protecting these sophisticated investors who had the wool pulled over their eyes.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to the movie. I understand Adam McKay is the director, and he's one of my favorites from The Big Short. So those listeners who have seen that one and now understand the mortgage meltdown now will understand Bad Blood.
Absolutely. And Jennifer Lawrence is supposed to be playing Elizabeth Holmes. So that will be very interesting as well.
Well, we'll stay tuned for that. But, you know, I want to ask you something about this program at the SEC. You mentioned that's how you became connected with Tyler and the scope of your representation of him, but how do these programs work? It sounds like it's a wonderful incentive, an economic incentive for whistleblowers to come forward. Is that the way you see these programs working?
Absolutely. I think what's really interesting, and my perspective has changed having moved to London. Most of my career was working representing whistleblowers under these programs within the United States, is that I think I came to appreciate being in London that this is sort of a uniquely American phenomenon, that we have created these programs that do more than just protect whistleblowers after the fact from retaliation, but instead actually empower whistleblowers to come forward and bring their information about wrongdoing to the very regulatory authority or agency who can do something about it. And if you see the platitudes from folks, the prosecutors of the DOJ, at the SEC, anyone who has whistleblower programs, they will tell you whistleblowers are their number one enforcement tool. They're one of the most effective ways for them to successfully prosecute cases because, of course, a lot of these people are insiders and can provide a roadmap to the fraud. So what's unique about the American programs is that We give you a clear roadmap on you, if you bring your information to the SEC and submit it in a particular form, you are entitled to receive, if the information you gave the SEC helps them to impose a fine or take an enforcement action, impose a penalty, the whistleblower is entitled to between 10 and 30% of that amount. And that's why we call them whistleblower reward programs. What's interesting is what that money seeks to do is really be an incentive to whistleblowers who are sitting on the fence when they're recognizing a lot of the negatives that can come from whistleblowing, being retaliated against, blacklisted, that we wanted to put a carrot or a safety net under them to encourage them to come forward and undertake that risk.
Well, that could be a huge payout if you're talking about a substantial company or a major concern. I'm thinking about someone like Ed Pearson over at Boeing. I can't even calculate that. I understand Constantine and Cannon, your firm also represents Ed.
That's right. We do represent Ed. Ed is, there are, fortunately for all of us, there are several whistleblowers who've exposed the problems with the 737 MAX. We are fortunate enough to represent Ed Pearson, who worked in the plant, in Boeing's plant, and was able to see that the problems extended more beyond just the software and, in fact, to problems that were going on the production line. So he went and testified in front of Congress to give them this information. But what's so interesting about Ed, which was featured in the New York Times story, is that he proves the point that we talked about earlier. He tried very hard to bring his concerns in to the company itself to get it to correct. He'd been a company man at Boeing after having worked in the military for years. And really enjoyed the Boeing family. He took it all the way up to some of the highest levels and was rebuffed. Then he went to the FAA and was similarly rebuffed. And it was only after trying those avenues that he ultimately turned to the press.
Well, I have to tell you, we have hit on two of my high sensitive areas, needles and airplanes. makes me scared about both. So what's going on with the Boeing case and what's going on with Ed?
So Ed continues to, after the testimony before Congress, he's been continuing to assist the investigations, and he's continues to provide information. So he is still in that phase. As you know, it takes a while for these matters to progress. So he's still assisting and providing information.
Well, I think one of the morals of the story of this conversation clearly has to be that whistleblowers should be seen as assets and not liabilities for companies.
I absolutely agree. And I actually think folks, we often say they should be seen as the CEO's best friend. A lot of people, and I'm among them, like to use the business parlance and say whistleblowers are forward indicators of risk. And having worked with whistleblowers for 23 years, I absolutely believe that they are the kind of employee you need to celebrate rather than vilify. And that's because they are highly attuned to seeing what's wrong, trying to bring your attention to it so that it can be corrected and before it sort of metastasizes and becomes a big problem that, you know, can no longer be handled inside the company. So, that has certainly been my experience. And what I'm very excited to talk about is that there's been some research recently coming out of George Washington University that actually also corroborates our view.
Yeah, that's the Welch and Steuben study. I think they go on to report that higher whistleblower report volume is the fewer and lower amounts of government fines and material lawsuits occur. That seems counterintuitive to me, but I think it goes to your point of being a canary in the coal mine as opposed to the skunk at the picnic.
Absolutely. The research that Professors Steubens and Welch have done has really given the ability for us to say, to prove that really whistleblowers are an asset to the company. In fact, they have a positive effect on your bottom line because they, by trying to give you this information, They're giving you the opportunity to correct it before it gets to becomes a real problem. So what's interesting is when you talk to Professor Welch, he'll say, yes, it is counterintuitive. The finding is that companies that have hotlines that are ringing off the hook, where people are calling all the time, are healthier than those who have hotlines that are silent. That absolutely seems counterintuitive, but the information and the data had shown that really what happens is that if you've created a culture where people feel safe to report, then that means you're a healthy company and you're getting lots of information that you can then act upon. Those canaries are singing, and they're not silent. So Kyle also says that it's sort of like being the parent of a teenager, which I think is hilarious. He says, if the teenagers are talking to you, you can do something about it. But it's if they're not talking to you, you can't address things until it's way out of control. So I thought that was a really interesting analogy, and one as the parent of two teenage boys can completely relate to.
Mary, I have two teenage girls, so I get
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and think about how do you create a culture where your teenagers talk to you? It's just the same as how do you create a corporate culture where your employees talk to you? It's analogous. I think there's similar challenges.
Well, Mary, I have to ask you the quintessential What Does It Profit podcast question. So what does your work profit? What's its legacy? What's the purpose behind what you're doing?
I feel very fortunate to have chosen the career that I have and to work with the attorneys in the practice group that I do. Because what's so interesting and what I feel like the profit is that in a capitalist society, part of what we do is we provide private resources to under-resourced government agencies to help them do their job. So it's sort of interesting. We describe a lot of these whistleblower programs as public-private partnerships because our whistleblowers help under-resourced, understaffed prosecutors do their job better. So for me, it feels like I have all of the benefits of assisting prosecutors without working for the government, but instead to help these very courageous people who are seeing wrongdoing and help them shepherd them through that process and get them to the prosecutors who can do something with it. So I sort of sit in an unusual posture. I'm not a prosecutor. I don't represent the government, but I assist the government by helping my clients bring forth invaluable information that helps them to do their job.
Mary, you're doing God's work.
It is a pleasure.
On behalf of all of the listeners of the What Does It Profit podcast, I really thank you for coming in and sharing these stories with us. Not only are they examples of very bad behavior, but good intentions to do right. So we hope to inspire folks to do the right thing. So Mary, thanks for helping us change the culture around whistleblowers, and come back and talk to us.
Thank you so much, Don. It's been entirely my pleasure.
This is What Does It Profit? Links to resources related to the issues we've discussed in this episode are in the show notes. Tell us what you think in a rating and review on your favorite podcast app. It really does help. More information about the show can be found at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. In our next episode, we're going to be talking about rotten apples with corporate ethicist Kirk Hansen. Hansen stretches the traditional apple analogy from bad apples to bad barrels to bad orchards, and offers the Syndex for putting bad behavior into perspective, and offers a prescription for repair and renewal.
We make an argument that it isn't just the damage is being done, people are dying because of corporate misconduct. We argue that it's really damaging our capitalist system, our confidence in the free market.
In the meantime, let your friends know about the show. Quick sharing links can be found on our website. We would love to hear from you. Show ideas and comments are always welcome. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at WDIP Podcast. What Does It Profit Podcast is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. The show is produced by Jordan Gaspour. Executive producers are Nate Toby and Barbara Landis. Special thanks to our talented interns, Nate, Niels, Hannah, and Andrew, and our friends at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business, Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, Business for Impact, the Beck Center for Social Impact and Innovation, the DC chapter of Conscious Capitalism and Switchinboard Studios. And a special shout out to our friends at Castbox for adding us to their staff favorites list. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?